Are you there, Vanessa?
Yes, hello. I am. Hi. Hello, Kevin.
Welcome to the show. I'd just like to give the audience a little bit of background on your work. You've been the recipient of several awards, including the 2016 IPPY Bronze Medal in Literary Fiction and the 2014 Gold Medal in Short Fiction. With Vanessa's latest collection of short stories called Perfect Conditions, Vanessa would likely add another award to her collection. Perfect Conditions is, in a word, lonely. How's that for a start? The characters that Blakeslee creates are as complex as they are interesting. The one commonality that all of the short stories in this collection seem to share is the characters are all lost in some way or another. This theme not only ties the stories to each other, but it also relates to the reader as it is the true human experience. Vanessa will be a writer in residence this fall at the Steker Center for Art and Ecology in Oregon. Before we go into our interview between us, I would like the studio to play a short that Vanessa recorded with Last Born on the Wilderness. Studio, could you run that short clip, please?
I forgive a little bit of self-promotion, but I released a TEDx talk I did a few months ago, got released, and you were commenting under it. But the thing you mentioned was really, really fascinating was this dark night of the soul, which I think when we're talking about people who look at the information for what it is and then try to really think about, well, what the hell is actually happening? What does this actually mean? Like, okay, so just recently a report came out that there's like the ice in the Antarctic is disappearing at an accelerating rate. I mean, it's there's all of these various data points that one can look at. And if you look at the bigger picture, you're saying, well, this planet's undergoing massive changes. Well, what does that mean for me as a person and for my family and for humanity as a whole? I mean, what does it actually mean? And that really can put someone in a very, I guess the term is the dark night of the soul, right? This sort of this.
That's the term I use. Yeah, yeah. I can't think of. I mean, I certainly didn't come up with that phrase, but it's the phrase I turn to because I think it perfectly captures what the journey is. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think many people don't want to go through that experience, but I wouldn't even say that I. Regarding this type of information, I don't think you ever get over it. It's not like you, it's like you have that phase of, I guess, introspection, depression, grief, but you never really come out of it completely, but you do find a way to maybe work with it in a way. And then maybe art, like with your writing and maybe with me, I do podcasts, I guess is my way of coping with this information, because it's really too big to really get a handle on. So for me, I'm just like, well, I want to talk to a bunch of people about it and I want to make people more aware of it. For you, you're like, well, how can we use stories to process this information as well? Like, let's contemplate what it actually means to be a human being, to be enamored by stories and to want to tell stories. How does this event that's unfolding fit into your passion in particular? So I guess I would ask you that. So like, how does the dark night of the soul, this processing of this information fit into your passion and what you want to do with your writing?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that, because initially when I was really in the thick of it, I was really depressed. I had done all of this research, and I think it was, I can't remember if it was prior to Trump being elected or after, where I really wanted to ask myself, I was looking to do another novel project too, and I've started another novel. I was just like, what matters right now? What stories really need to be told? And in asking that, I had to really ask myself, well, and why are things so screwed up? What is going on? Just what is the state? What is going on? And I haven't watched mass media for years, and I've certainly done my amount of research for my first book on, you know, what the CIA has been up to, neoliberal economic policies, all of those things. So I was up on that. And then I really was wanting to know what was up with climate change. And I started to research that. And initially, you know, if you just read the mainstream articles, it's like, oh, maybe it's not that bad. They end on a lot of hope at the bottom, and they quote the 2100 a lot, at least, and this was a couple of years ago. They've gotten more dire, but and then I dug a little bit deeper, and I spent more time on like phys.org and, you know, the science journals, and then I think you know, just different people's podcasts, and I came about, I did come through the you know, Guy McPherson site as a sort of like a way station.
Yeah.
But by that point, I had already, as a critical thinker, sort of put my detective map out and was Googling, you know, what is peak oil, resource depletion, all of these things. And I was like, we're screwed, man. You know, I can't, yeah. The rational person in me is like, oh, we're really done. Like, it's just, we're done.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. Yeah.
And so I pummeled into that whole that journey. And when I was really in the thick of it, really depressed, I was like, you know, what does it matter? Do I even write anymore? Is there a point to this? Because it's a lot of hard work to write fiction, literary fiction. It's not easy. You're talking a sacrifice of time, research, little to no money.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
You know, do people even read this stuff? Do you know, how many people even care if I'm going to write a book that sells a few thousand copies? What do I want to do with my time left? And ultimately, though, I came out of that, and you don't ever really, it doesn't ever go away from you, even when you are further into the acceptance phase. But you do learn how to manage it more. And I would imagine it's what someone who's been given the diagnosis of a terminal illness goes through, that you are still living, you know, and I think on the outside, we often question that when friends and family members get cancer or something. Well, how are they still working? How are they still? Well, they have to, you know, they go through this. This is what they go through, I would imagine. And we're just going through it prematurely as, you know, otherwise healthy adults in our prime. And what really came out for me was that there was a shift, and my life became less about all of these things that I thought were important. Like, although I love to travel, I realized that travel is really a sort of secondary, you know, pursuit. It's not as important as I had made it out to be. And life is really more about people. It's about the relationships we have, having good relationships, and asking, how can I be of service to others? I really felt differently. I came to a whole different approach about my work that I think had to happen. That for me, it was part of the growth I needed to do. The growth that I've needed to do as a person and as a writer, it really can't be separated. Those are two things that are fused together, really. So it's interesting that for the next, whatever the next phase will be of my writing, with whatever time I have left, I'm coming from that place of asking, what are the stories that people need to hear? And I feel like the stories had throughout the 20th century, they're not going to be the stories that are going to serve us for this new period of time, even if it's a short period. And so what are the stories we need to hear? I think we need to, and if they're not going to be stories about false hope, you know, so what lies beyond hope, without mm-hmm. being too grim?
Sure, right.
Or facing really grim circumstances. Well, I think it's finding that whatever experiences human beings have gone through, along with the darkness, there are stories of people acting upon their higher selves. There always is that interplay. It kind of reminds me of watching Mount Kilauea erupt, and here's this incredible destruction. Also, I'm always caught by surprise of the hypnotic beauty of watching that lava.
Oh yeah.
It's just so strange, this paradox. And I think that can be true too of the stories that I feel compelled to tell of how of people maybe surprising each other, and along with brutality, that people will also help each other.
Well, Vanessa, I think that gives our audience a reasonable idea of where you've come from or where you're at. Can we go back to your original novel and then work our way forward to where we are now and what you're writing about now?
Absolutely. And thank you so much, Kevin, for having me on today. And thank you for running that. That was an excellent conversation that I'd had with Patrick Farnsworth, who hosts the Last Born in the Wilderness blog or podcast. I'm sorry. That was just from a couple of months ago. So thank you for that lovely introduction. But yes, my first novel, which came out in 2015, Juventud, followed young activists in Colombia, in South America, through all kinds of pitfalls and dangers in exposing the sort of neoliberal backdrop of that story. And when I came out of that, I really wanted to explore some different terrain. And I'd been writing stories along the side as I was working on that novel. And as I went about my research, I really was stunned to realize how much hot water we're in. I guess I'd been in a sort of tunnel. As you have to be when you're writing a novel. I had been narrowly focused on Juventud and on the economic injustice in the world and unmasking neoliberalism, and I'm very glad that I went about that. That was part of my journey. But at the same time, I really didn't realize how much trouble we were in terms of the ecological crisis and the climate crisis. So that's really what led me to write some news stories for my new book, Perfect Conditions. And a few of those stories had been written prior. And they're not all about collapse, but a good number of them are about characters facing economic crisis in their lives, as well as dealing with different aspects of the ecological crisis in Perfect Conditions.
Fantastic. Thank you. As you've gone through this journey and you've seen how, and you've just said that you've discovered the situation was much worse than you thought. And, you know, that's a classic indictment of the corporate media, where they've only told us a portion of the story. But as you've gone through that, how have you managed your grief when this realization of how dire the situation is?
Oh my goodness, that's such a good question, and one that I haven't been asked before. And I'll say that my first response is to say that I didn't write. I actually didn't turn to writing first. I was, really, really depressed, and I think I escaped into movies for a while first. You know, just my partner and I were watching B science fiction movies. And that may sound kind of funny, but I really was a bit numbed out. I mean, very numbed out. I wanted to be closer with my loved ones and really felt a sense of reaching out toward people who I wanted to have in my life and maybe, you know, creating some distance from others who I've found been a cause of strife in my life. So there's that. I think it causes you to reassess quite a bit. And at first I went through, as many people do, a panicked phase of wanting to prep and maybe assessing whether I should go learn permaculture or try to farm. And I'm still somewhat interested in exploring those things. I mean, planting trees and gardening is a wonderful, wonderful practice, no matter what's going on in the world. It's fantastic. But ultimately, I came to the realizations that, you know, I'm not going to transition from a modern industrialized human with a, you know, master's degree in the arts and humanities, in the fine arts, to a permaculture organic farmer. That's not really going to be something feasible for me or my partner as a longtime city dweller who doesn't own land. And so that's not going to happen. We are going to have to just deal with things as they come and make the best of it. And how can you really, beyond really prep for a short amount of time for a sort of short-term disaster, how could you really prepare for something like the demise of civilization? I don't really think that one can. So, you know, in our house, we don't really have anything beyond what we'd need for a month of some kind of extreme disaster emergency. So that was really my trajectory. But I didn't go to any kind of therapy or counseling. I just sought really support online. And fortunately, there's a number of different private groups online. I'm a member of the NTHE Near Term Human Extinction Support Group. I also happen to run the evidence page for that group. So if you follow the Near Term Human Extinction evidence page, I'm always posting articles on there for the public, to those who are interested in seeking out that information, to have it. But I do believe that if you are going to give out that information, that you need to point people in the direction of support, because it is, as you mentioned, quite a bit to process. You do go through the dark night of the soul. And so fortunately, there are a number of online groups. And, you know, I believe people are starting to hopefully meet in their communities and reach out to one another just, you know, for support on the ground, which is really where it needs to be, is to find like-minded people who know what's going on in one's area, or what is going to be coming down the pike, perhaps I should say.
I like to always defer to the famous quote from Edward Abbey, where he said, "Action is the antidote to despair." And I think juggling the reality of knowing how bad the situation is and coming up with positive, constructive action is a very difficult dichotomy. I have the privilege and luxury of living on a beautiful island in the South Pacific, and dear friends of mine have set up a not-for-profit nursery where we're propagating native trees on a rewilding program. And this week, I'll give you an idea of how my week panned out. Because of an accident that I had a few years ago, or 6 years ago now, I can't dig and shovel, and I can't do all of the normal things that I used to be able to do when I was a younger guy and before I broke myself. But I have a team of planters been out here all week, and we've got 1,000 plants in this week. And all my job is they call me Rakino Uber. We're on the Uber driver. All I get to do is drive around. They do all the hard work. They come back at the end of the day covered in mud and sweat. And I pick them up, usually with a couple of cold beers, to make sure it's a nice way for them to finish their day. But 2 days ago, I took them down after their hard day's work. I took them down to the wharf to get on the Auckland Sea Shuttle taxi to take them back home. And a 3 orca swam into the bay. It was a family, the 2 parents and a young pup. And they swam into the bay, and they were about 25 or 30 meters away from us. And we all stood and looked at each other. It was one of those really special moments that you have in the wilderness when you're out in nature and you get to interact with other species and such charismatic species like orca coming in and doffing their hat to you as they go by is a pretty amazing experience. So that's sort of for me how I deal with trying to metabolize this information.
Oh, I'm so glad you shared that. It sounds like such a wonderful moment. And I will add that before I went back to writing, again, I was kind of paralyzed for a while. And I felt like I couldn't write, or I didn't know quite how to process this in words. I felt really drawn to be with Mother Nature as well. And my partner and I really, pressed him to, on our days off from work, go out to state parks. We live in Florida, which is, of course, hugely overdeveloped, and it's kind of a train wreck in that regard. But there are still amazingly beautiful places in Florida to be with the ecology, the Merritt Island National Wildlife Refuge, Cape Canaveral National Seashore, the St. Mark's National Wildlife Refuge up in the Panhandle. So many places. We finally went down to the Everglades this past year, which had been on my list for 20 years, and I had never been down there. But this is how we live as modern people. We often live in these cities, and a few hours away there are these incredible wildernesses, and often we don't go and visit them and spend time there. So it was a remarkable year of having experiences, and one that we had similar to what you just shared was we were on this long drive in, I believe it was from Big Cypress National Preserve to Everglades National Park, this remote route, and this winter, and as we were on this road through the swamp, all these different water birds were just before us in the trees and peeling off as we came down this road, and they kept peeling off in this cascading V for miles and miles of these egrets and herons and just gorgeous birds. And then we even saw an owl. An owl was in the road and it flew up into the tree next to us, and we were just 6 or 8 feet away from this big owl staring back at us. And we had one of those moments that you described with the orcas. It's just so amazing. So I would never trade that for the world, and I don't know that I would have been as attuned to go out and seek those experiences had I not realized how dire the situation is.
I absolutely agree with that, and I think it's a really important takeout. A lot of people avoiding this issue, and they don't want to talk about it, and they don't want to consider the severity of the crisis. But one of the things that this knowledge has done for me is it's given me a heightened appreciation and passion for the natural world. And I think once we get to this point, we get to enjoy everything so much more because we understand that the danger that it's in.
Oh, we do. And so I would say, again, referring to your quote about action, I think there's a fear in telling people, there's a fear among certain people that, don't let others know about how dire it is, because people will be completely paralyzed. They won't do anything. They won't take action. And that's really not true. There's a time of processing. And what happens is there's a reassessment that goes on about about where your action is coming from and perhaps what kind of action to take. So, but we definitely ended up taking meaningful action. I probably took more meaningful action in my life than I would had I not realized how dire it was, because we spent the year with this sort of New Year's resolution to go out and support wildlife sanctuaries who were rescuing and rehabilitating, you know, exotic animals and native species of Florida and the state parks. And I don't know that we would have done that. So, and I have several essays I've written about those experiences, and hopefully they should be placed soon in journals and magazines in the next few months. So those essays should be coming out. And so again, I was able to write again, you know, after having those experiences and moving through grief. And I won't say acceptance is, it's not a finite state. You move in and out. I think both grief and forgiveness are processes that are always in flux. They don't just end one day. You know, when you are in the process of forgiving someone, you often spend your whole life reaffirming that forgiveness and rising to the challenge to keep forgiving them as you deal with them in your life, sometimes till your dying day. And I feel like grief is very much the same.
I think we should talk a little bit more about how the big NGOs and the green movement say that we shouldn't talk about how bad and how dire the situation is in the fear of invoking paralysis, as you mentioned. I find that a very patronizing and patriarchal approach to dealing with people. I think it's completely dishonest to tone down the conversation because you don't want to create any kind of paralysis is the word that you use. But what I find about their whole position is that it's effectively lying. It's lying about how bad the situation is. And because we're not discussing openly about the coming collapse, or not the coming collapse, the unfolding collapse, because we're not talking about it honestly, we're not coming up with strategies for the future. All of that narrative is operating in the past. There's an extraordinary level of cognitive dissonance in that perspective.
Correct. I completely agree. I think it's cognitive dissonance. I think it's ends up being a disingenuousness. Ends up being actually absurd if you've been, you know, doing your own homework and then seeing what they're trying to put forth. There's a real absurd humor to it. What they're espousing when you get to a certain point. And I'm not involved in the NGO movements. I never was from that world. But I think there's two things. I had said earlier there's a fear of paralysis, but I think the other fear is, of course, that people will panic. So between either worrying that people will absolutely go crazy and wreak havoc everywhere and completely stop going to work and completely wreak violence upon their neighbors, versus paralysis, the fear that people will do absolutely nothing and be a deer in the headlights and just shut down. You know, I don't think the truth is either of those things. I think human beings are capable of sort of moving in and out of different states, again, are more in flux than that. But yes, I do think it's very interesting. You know, there was a paper that was went viral by a professor of sustainability named Jem Bendel, and it's called, if you Google it, The Study on Collapse They Thought You Should Not Read Yet, which is a rather fun paper that takes you about 30 minutes to read, where he's pretty blunt, and I was really pleased when this paper went around, and I even helped share it a bit in different groups and tweeted it to some different people, because I felt like it was because of what you're talking about. It's so important to at least get people, especially from the NGO world, to really come to some kind of grips with exactly how far along we are. and that this isn't 20 years ago. You know, many years have passed and things have just gotten worse, and we're in a predicament without real solutions. And so we had better prepare. And when I talk about preparing, I mean it more psychologically than actually physically. I think the wisest preparation one can do is again, for your, it happens internally. And then, you know, with the people who you bring into your life, your friends, your neighbors, your loved ones, and your animals too. We should include them. We're all in this together. So, and I know you're aware of that paper as well. I just found that a very interesting turn in the public discussion.
After this interview has been uploaded to the PRN website, I will post it on my website with all the relevant links that we've talked about, and I'll especially include the Jim Bendel article. It was a really spectacularly important approach that when he first sent that paper off for peer review, it got knocked back. They didn't want to publish it, and he ended up publishing it without peer review for that reason, because he believed that, and I believed it with him, that it was a really important to actually show people how dire the situation is. When we talked about paralysis, I'll tell you a funny anecdotal story from one of my yacht deliveries. I was getting ready to take a boat from New Zealand up to Fiji, and I had a crew member that was, I didn't know, but who was linked to the owner. And I was showing him around the boat, giving him instructions on how we operate the boat, how we were going to do things. And I showed him this 1 meter long set of bolt cutters that were down in the toolbox. And I said, if we need it, here's the bolt cutters. And he looked at me with puzzlement and he said, why would we need bolt cutters? And I said, well, if the boat gets rolled or pitch poled and we get dismasted in a storm, one of the things we have to do is cut the mast free before it beats the boat to death. And this bloke looked at me, and it obviously hadn't occurred to him that something so catastrophic could happen, and that we could be in the water upside down with our mast pointing at the bottom of the ocean and our keel pointing at the sky, and that we'd have to come up with a solution.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, one of the reasons why I talk about how dire the situation is going to be and what we should be doing about it is because I'm interested in risk management, and I'm interested in the precautionary principle. And the precautionary principle has been completely abandoned by the scientific community when we talk about abrupt climate change.
Right. And I'm just so glad you shared that, because what that reminded me of, what, you know, we often talk about the loss of critical thinking skills in our culture today, at the point at which where we find the culture. But I think what is perhaps less talked about is that I see a failure of imagination. And, you know, it may be, maybe we should blame screen culture and media. The author David Foster Wallace had an incredible essay about television and what he saw as a very dire trajectory for the young people of America. That essay was written in the 1990s. But, you know, I wonder, as a fiction writer, and with people reading less literature and fiction and engaging with art, if their imaginations, if that isn't a large part to blame for people's lack of imagination about this. I mean, one of the things, I love movies and good television shows as much as the next person, but TV and film watching is more of a passive experience. The world is being created for you. The characters and the dialogue, everything is being supplied for you. Whereas when you read a work of fiction, short stories or novels, you are imagining for yourself how the protagonist looks, how the setting looks. And that is, I think, a very powerful process. It certainly leads to a certain kind of catharsis. And I mean, you've just really reminded me about why it's so important to come up with new stories and to write for people to encounter new stories in this time as part of our precautionary preparation going forward.
On the subject of writing, I have a very exciting time coming up in the new year, assuming that industrial civilization holds together into the new year. A friend of the show and a former guest of the show is Dar Jamail. Dar writes at truthout.org, and he's an absolutely wonderful journalist who's had an incredible career. Started out as an unembedded war journalist in Iraq, and then he went down a similar path than you. You know, he was a writer, and then he learned about the climate crisis, and then he became completely immersed in the climate crisis. Dar has a new book coming out in January called The End of Ice, and he's going to come to New Zealand and Australia, and he'll be doing tours there, launching the book, and I will tour New Zealand with him doing that. And I'll keep, you know, people posted via my website and via social media. And I think everyone should look out for that book from Dar. But the reason I mention it is because Dar knows how dire the situation is. Dar knows that we're heading to a brick wall at light speed. But he's continuing doing what he thinks is important and writing about what he thinks is important. And this is where I completely reject the paralysis argument from the corporatized NGOs, because people like us aren't sitting on our asses not doing anything. We're facing the challenge. We're looking it in the eye. And I admire you, and I admire the whole extended team. Patrick Farnsworth, one of the people that you talked about earlier with his podcast, Last Born in the Wilderness, Patrick has interviewed Dar Jamail, and I'll include that in the show notes for on my blog post. I think the good people will continue to do the right thing. And the people who are going to shut out or shut off, those people would have done so anyway or haven't been engaged. But when it comes to the issue of people saying that we are taking away hope from people, well, first of all, there was no hope. Once you go off the cliff, once you're Thelma and Louise in the convertible that has already gone off the cliff, you don't have hope. You have moments to make the best of. And I think that's what we're trying to do. Different manifestations of what we do. We're trying to show people that you can be positive and you can take something out of it whilst that we're in that very short period of time before we hit the wall.
Absolutely. And all one has to do is read either Limits to Growth or Overshoot or, you know, several of these books that were written a long time ago in terms of resource depletion and overshooting of carrying capacity to realize we were in deep, deep trouble decades ago, climate change aside. And I just recently read Overshoot. But yeah, I do believe that those of us who are engaged in self-reflection in our lives, it spurs a deeper self-reflection and perhaps a deeper crisis, but that one comes out of it. And, you know, there were the musicians on the Titanic who resolved to play music until the very last moment when they were heading into the water until the very last moment they decided who they were going to be. And they weren't just rearranging deck chairs. And I think that is illuminating to think, I mean, again, in talking about the arts and the power of the arts, those musicians followed their dharma, if you will, with tremendous courage, even when they knew all was lost in the last minutes of their lives.
A friend of mine, or a social media friend of mine, who is going to come and visit me with her husband, Scott, is Stephanie Stephen, and she's a musician. And she's been writing music about the collapse and about the unfolding extinction event. Stephanie's got a great YouTube channel called Stephanie Stephen, and I'll include one or two of her songs in my blog post so that people can listen to some fantastic art talking about the same kind of thing that you and I are talking about now.
Oh, absolutely. I see this. My partner is a wonderful jazz composer and also composer of classical music. And this was several years ago. And he had been tremendously moved by the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, the terrible, terrible spill we had here. And he composed a symphonic movement called Songs from the Gulf of Sorrows. And he's continuing to write jazz pieces, many of which, as we've traveled around, as I mentioned, to the different wildlife sanctuaries and refuges in Florida, he's constantly inspired by the wildlife. And I think many of us are going through our own processes, even if we're those of us who might not be as outspoken about what we're witnessing and feeling. It's coming out, it's emerging. In the US right now, we have a very notable poet. This month, she's on the cover of Poets and Writers magazine. Her name is Ada Limón, and she has a new book out called The Carrying. And I've read a couple of poems from it. They excerpted it in, along with her author interview in Poets and Writers. And they're very, I think they're very earnest poems about the times we find ourselves in. They have that tone, they have that weight to them. And of someone who is staring into the darkness and reporting back. And I think we just need this work so much now, more than ever.
I've just had two new books arrive. I'm still buying paperbacks, and I buy these.
Thank you.
Yeah, I've got yours here. Don't worry. I buy paperbacks because I make the joke that I've been a reader since I was reading before I went to school. My parents taught me how to read and write before I went to school, and I've got two books that I've just arrived. One of them is called Beyond Hope by Deb Ozarko.
Yes.
I haven't read it yet, but there is a whole genre of books coming out around the collapse and around the convergence of these multiple threats to not just our civilization, but to complex life on the planet generally.
Yes, well, and it's so important, I think, that we read across genres. That I love nonfiction. I'm an information junkie, so of course I'm gobbling up books like Overshoot, and you know I still need to read Peter Wadham's Farewell to Ice, and you know Joseph Tinker and these other books that are on my list. But I think it's really important, again, as a voice from the arts and humanities, to connect that with who we are as beings, as human beings. And so I encourage readers to check out alongside their nonfiction reading to turn to poetry, to turn to short fiction. And it's funny, often I feel like with creative people, the subconscious is wiser than the conscious mind goes about the day. And I realized that I was contemplating these issues, some deeper part of my psyche was onto these issues long before I thought I was. So I was writing stories like I have one story in my book called Sustainable Practices about plastic pollution and a young couple who end up honeymooning at a hipster kind of eco-friendly resort in Tahiti, but really realize that, you know, it's a story about hypocrisy to a certain extent in our culture, and you know how we think we can be green and hip, but we're really, you know, just contributing to more of the same. And so I had written that story a number of years ago. I'd written a prepping story more recently, but I was really on to these subjects for longer than I was aware. When I went to put my book together, it really kind of stunned me. That, you know, there's a part of our psyche that's wiser than the person who just goes about the day, you know, prattling and and watching TV and doing shopping for groceries. And that's really heartening. I'm really glad for that. I'm really grateful for that.
I have a funny thing happening with my musical taste at the moment. I'm sensitized in everything about what I do. You know, I'm much more sensitive about how I walk and walk on Gaia and how I treat the ecosystem around me. And I've listened to music all my life, you know, since I was a young guy. And I look back now on the musicians like Joni Mitchell and Neil Young. Remember Joni Mitchell's seminal song, Yellow Taxi?
Of course.
These people were warning us 50 years ago.
Years ago, there were people who could see this coming. I mean, well, my goodness, we know the indigenous cultures could see this coming miles off, and they were heartbroken and terrified, you know, a couple of hundred years ago. But then even within the dominant patriarchal culture, we have had numerous wise, many of them musicians and artists and sort of poet philosophers who've seen this. And, you know, the Dark Mountain Project is based on the writings of, and I'm forgetting his name right now, but the poet who inspired that project.
Hingsnorth.
Yes, he was yeah. Onto that. And so, you know, you look back, and for me as a younger person, I'm not quite 40, I've just turned 39, to realize that, you know, this has been unfolding since before I was born. And I always knew we were in trouble from a young age, but I just didn't quite realize how much trouble that it would be really hitting the fan in my prime, in my lifetime. So I'm so glad these voices are out there and you can seek them out. I mean, I think it's just as important to find, you know, the contemporary voices who are broaching this, as well as you said, Joni Mitchell, Neil Young, the artists from the past who were, you know, very much speaking about the same things.
I think that we have an important role to play by doing podcasts and radio shows like this, because there's been such a catastrophic failure of the mainstream and corporate media, and to a large degree, the alt media as well. One of the things I've noticed on social media in the last months is that there are more and more articles being published about the climate crisis. None of them would use the word climate crisis, but that's what they're talking about. There are big corporate organizations like The Independent and The Guardian in England who are regularly posting articles, publishing articles, and they're talking about the danger of going into a hothouse earth or something along those lines. But what people, I would really wish people would do is that they would drill down better into those articles and see what is not being said. They keep telling us, oh, if we don't do this in the next 10 years, we're fucked. Well, excuse me. In 1989, the UN published a paper that said, if we don't get act on climate change, we've got a 10-year window of opportunity to avoid dangerous climate change. Okay, well, they did nothing. I suspect they looked into it and realized in 1989 it was already too late.
They may have. And, you know, I take this with a chuckle because it's been in 10 years for all of my life. All of my life they've been saying, if we don't do something within 10 years, well, 40 years have gone by since I've been born. So nothing's been done. And maybe they even looked into, I mean, as I cited with the book Overshoot, and you've read Limits to Growth, that even the, you know, global warming, if you just don't even consider that yet as a factor, and you look at all the other issues with the soil depletion, with the aquifers being depleted, with you know, ocean acidification, all of these issues, deforestation, and the trouble we're in just from that alone, and then you add abrupt global warming on top of it, abrupt climate disruption. It's really game over. And I know people don't want to hear that, but the sooner one comes to grips with it, I think the better. And I completely agree, Kevin.
I think that the biosphere and all complex life on it is in hospice. And I have had some pretty extraordinary hospice experiences. I had the honor and pleasure, and I say that without a word of irony, the pleasure of providing my mother hospice care when she was dying. I looked after her for 6 weeks, and it was the six best weeks we ever had together. We really had a wonderful, honest time. In the last few days on the island where I live, there's 21 residents. I have a tiny tribe in amongst those 21, and one of them died this week. And we've been, as a collective on the island and with Sandra's darling family, we've been providing her with hospice care. And hospice can be a wonderful, wonderful experience. I suggest that everyone start treating our situation like it's in hospice, that we're in hospice. Start loving and looking and guiding and helping each other as best we can. Now is the time to form a tribe. There's been no more important time in history to form a tribe and to look after each other than we are now. And I think that we can take this situation and put a good spin on it and a good outcome on it, where we all just look after each other, be more compassionate, be more caring.
Well, and really think about this, Kevin. What's the downside in that? What's the downside in acting out of more kindness? What's the downside in acting, you know, coming to terms with a greater sense of gratitude and living from that place? I don't see any downside in that. You know, I only see deeper meaning. And part of this, of course, is that we've become so detached from the process of death in an honest way in our industrialized culture. You know, just a few decades ago, people used to lay out bodies in the parlor. You know, the family used to dig graves, as they still do in many parts of the world. But that all changed in places like the U.S. and Australia and Canada and the first world in the last, you know, really, it's an anomaly in history that we've invented these funeral parlors. And, you know, we don't have anything to do with dead bodies. We don't really see death. We're not in touch with it in the way we were as a people. And in the way many other tribal people and those who are living closer to village life and the land are elsewhere in the world. And so I think the best we could do is take that attitude. And I see it myself as a witness being out in refuges that the ecosystem is really suffering. It's doing, you know, you could say somewhat better in some places where it's perhaps less infringed upon by human development, but it's really in terrible trouble, and on the whole, as we see in the onslaught of articles. But you can see it within your own experience if you've been paying attention. I couldn't agree more. Let's be there for each other, and let's remember to turn to art and music and stories and films and all of those things to help us through it, that provides a catharsis for us to come together and bear witness.
Another quote that I would like to use that I am very attached to is from Joanna Macy. And she said, "Because of social taboos, despair at the state of our world, and fear for our future are rarely acknowledged. The suppression of despair, like that of any deep recurring response, contributes to the numbing of the psyche." That quote comes from an article called The Greatest Danger, and I think it sums up exactly the situation we're in. The whole culture has been so bastardized, and we've been so compartmentalized into how that this dominant modern culture thinks that we should be behaving, that a lot of our traditions have been lost. In the Irish culture, when someone died, what used to happen at funerals was the word was keening, which was effectively wailing out loud. And that in my lifetime has stopped and become frowned upon. Whereas what it was is a really tangible release of that emotions, getting it out, not bottling it up, getting it out. I'm so glad that in this conversation we've had today, we've dealt with the issue of grief, because no one wants to do it. It's a grief-denying culture that we live in, and I think it's extraordinarily bad for us psychologically.
It is, and we're afraid of it. And when really grief calls upon us to listen, we don't, you know, we've become a culture of giving advice and judging, when really all you have to do, all someone who is grieving really wants, is just for someone else to be there, to be heard. And that enables one to move through grief and move through that process. And it could be so simple, but we've twisted it around. And, you know, time and again, I see this, that, you know, people want to give advice and action and suggestions, when really you can just offer acknowledgement and say, yes, I understand, I hear you, and allow the person to grieve, allow that feeling to be borne out.
And by enunciating it, it helps other people to enunciate it. So that's the important takeout from the show. We're coming to the end now. I'll give you one last time just to do a little bit of a summary. But before you do, I'd just like to make it a small announcement that the former host of the show, Professor Guy McPherson, is moving back to the United States in the near future. And I've asked him if he'll come back on the show and co-host it with me, and he said that he will. So that's the great news from me at Nature Bats Last. And if you would like to say one last thing, and then we'll hand it over to the studio.
Great. Thank you so much, Kevin. I just want to thank you for having me on. I'm happy to return anytime and continue the conversation. And if you'd like to get in touch with me, my website is vanessablakesley.com. I have a Facebook author page. My current book is called Perfect Conditions. It's a short story collection that deals with the economic and ecological crises we're in. I'll be, as Kevin mentioned earlier, a writer in residence at the Sitka Center for Art and Ecology this fall. I'll be at the Tampa Bay Times Festival of Reading in November. So if you'll be in those areas, please, you know, visit my website, and hopefully, you know, feel free to stop by and say hi when I'm out and about on book tour, or find me online.
Awesome. If you send all those details for me, I'll embed it on my website. Studio, we'll hand it over to you, and thank you everyone for listening, and remember, nature bats last.
Mother Nature, she's gonna